Renate, I'm apparently introducing myself. So I'm Bianca, I live here in the Bob Room. It's a bit dark sometimes. And I will speak about coarse graining, spin something models. We will see that spins will play a certain role. You can take it as quantum gravity, but you can also, if you're interested in other things, that might be also useful to consider these things. So the plan will be that I a bit review what are the challenges if you want to coarse grain spin forms, which are unfortunately a bit more complicated than the Ising models, apparently not so easy as causal dynamical triangulations. Then we will not consider spin forms, but we will consider 2D models with global symmetry. But these will show us already very, we can make them quite involved. And these consideration will already show us that it's important to look for good observables, which actually follow from a symmetry, in this case, a global symmetry. And this motivates also what we will do in higher dimensions and treating gauge symmetries. And I will shortly present a method which we term decorated tensor networks. So the tutorial today by Sebastian, which apparently can be used universally for all kinds of things, he will show you how to do 2D models with a global symmetry and how not to do them. So let's review the challenges. And these are, partially they apply to spin forms and partially they apply more generally for quantum gravity. I think the first one which I encountered as I was thinking about let's try to compute anything with spin forms is that spin form models have complex amplitudes. Meaning, the amplitudes are very complicated, but they are also really complex numbers. And we have heard a lot of about Monte Carlo simulations, and indeed, that's kind of still a bit the standard method for getting access for really complicated or easy models, depending on whether the easy model is easy or more complicated. But this needs really probability amplitudes for sampling. And so usually what is done is to consider Euclidean quantum gravity models to allow for these positive amplitudes. Actually, CDT is one example and cleverly avoids a number of deep problems. But in general, there are really deep problems with Euclidean quantum gravity, and we nicely avoid them in spin forms, and that's also, I think, still one of the key advantages of these models. So then, basically, I learned about tensor networks, and in fact, a priori, they can deal with complex amplitudes, so they didn't. That's, I think, why I was interested in applying tensor networks to spin forms. Always, if you try to coarse grain and consider coarse graining flow or renormalization flow, what happens is that a priori it's in an infinite dimensional coupling space. So here again, tensor networks are good because it's a huge coupling space. So a priori, the entire tensor might change. It's a finite number of couplings, but again, what you usually hope for is to find useful truncations in the coupling space. And indeed, the method implements a cutoff, but it's informed by the dynamics of the theory and, of course, by the ingenuity of the method you use. So there's also a hope that you can find useful truncations in your flow of couplings. Maybe a disadvantage is that mostly you just work with the tensors, and so there's another question in extracting useful observables. And so, the method I will speak about, the decorated tensor networks, and also in the symmetry protecting methods, we will see that we get a more direct access to observables and can hope to get a better understanding of induced cutoffs and extraction of couplings. Okay, so then, like the more technical challenges is that spin forms a priori, each edge or comes with infinitely many variables in the standard models without the cosmological constant. So this might not be a priori problem because you can still hope that somehow the amplitudes only are supported, you know, meaningfully on a compact subspace of this infinite range. And this, not for spin forms, but for other models, this has actually been considered in tensor networks. But it's we might not have this if you don't have a cosmological constant, due to the reason that we want to implement at some point diffeomorphism symmetry. And in this case, diffeomorphism symmetry is actually happening or has non-compact orbits. So we cannot really hope that we have amplitudes or that amplitudes concentrate on a compact subset, because that would be inconsistent with the fact that diffeomorphism symmetry in this case has is a non-compact gauge group. However, what you can do is to implement a cosmological constant. And at least if you consider Euclidean signature matrix models, which basically still is done like to 95%, the models itself have only finitely many variables. And the other thing is what is happening is indeed the gauge group gets compactified. And that's basically that the reason is that the model space you are considering is now a compact model space. It's not anymore R3, but it is, or R4. But it's the Zitter space. So in principle, we can implement the cosmological constant. It's also good because we do have a cosmological constant and reduce to finitely many variables. The drawback is still it's many, many variables because it's basically the number is inverse to the cosmological constant, and the cosmological constant in the real world happens to be very small. And so indeed, the main point of this talk will be to show you some techniques how to deal with many variables and more complicated models. Another challenge is that we need to start somewhere, basically, and spin forms are still very poorly understood. So any understanding is a bit of progress. So basically, many things which are actually understood, say, in lattice gauge theory with much simpler methods are still not understood in spin forms because these much simpler methods do not apply to spin forms. and this is even, you know, this all happens even before you ask kind of more complicated questions, is there a phase transition or not? So it's, you know, how to describe phases, what are good order parameters? This, unfortunately, can be a very hard question because again, it relates to diffeomorphism symmetry, and then you ask for diffeomorphism invariant observables, and that's in general a very hard question. what is a good choice, or even the best choice, for variables to coarse grain with a geometric interpretation? you know, this you could just start to check with the current methods, and indeed, in spin forms, we have many different choices for parameterizing or for writing our models and for choosing different variables. A better understanding of the, you know, space of generalized geometries we are actually flowing in, and the more general questions, because spin forms are generalized lattice gauge theories, are these lattice gauge theory variables actually a good choice or not? So, having understood these things, you can try to even ask, you know, can we get any idea of what kind of phases we can get out in from spin foams. Another challenge, which I will almost not talk about, is diffeomorphism symmetry, which is broken by the discretization, but it needs to be restored. But it's a very powerful symmetry, which again is not extremely well understood. And the main reason why this is the case is that there's actually a lack of examples. So we actually have no working diffeomorphism invariant QFT with propagating degrees of freedom. So the QFTs we know, which are diffeomorphism invariant, are really topological quantum field theories, and they only have kind of finitely many degrees of freedom. OK. So basically, the main point of this talk will be trying to deal with the fact that the models are very complicated and have many variables. And this brings me to the second part, which is models with a global symmetry. And that sometimes goes under the slogan symmetry protection. And here it also comes with observables, which actually follow from the symmetry, and making use of these observables in our design of the algorithm. And here I just say a few words to what these models are. I will not further describe these. So we have seen a bit spin foams. And actually, the kind of models I'm now dealing with, they are 2D. I mean, you can also define them in 3D on any dimension. But you can understand them to come from a kind of symmetry reduction of spin foams. So the idea is here that you try to keep the algebraic complexity of the models. But first, you try to consider kind of just two dimensions, because it's much easier to compute things in two dimensions and to learn what things can happen and to develop strategies. So this might give you an idea of what happens. Here I actually have a very simple spin foam. It has only two building blocks. So Benjamin had hypercubes. So instead of hypercubes, I actually consider building blocks which have many, many, many faces. I take only two of them and glue them together in all these faces. And then I can actually take a cut along transversal to these two kind of building blocks. And this I can represent as a 2D model, basically. And the end result is that in the spin foam model for each kind of building block, I have a symmetry, a gauge symmetry, which would be gauge symmetry if you would have many building blocks. But since I have only two, I get here two copies of this gauge symmetry. So we will have a 2D model with global symmetry here, because this global symmetry is now just choosing one group element here and choosing another group element here. And the symmetry group, I just call here H. And in principle, the models we would be interested in have an H, which is actually SU2 cross SU2, because this is roughly SO4. So we end up with a symmetry group, which in principle now is four copies of a group SU2. So that's a lot. And indeed, we could handle with this group with a little deformation. And it is interesting to consider all these copies, because an essential point of the dynamics of spin foams are certain kind of interactions, or how these group copies couple to each other. And that's known as simplicity constraints. But for the purpose of this talk, I will here consider just one copy, so models with one copy. And also, SA2 would lead to infinite many variables. So here I consider a quantum group, and that's what you will consider in the tutorial, I believe. Or if for the purpose, again, of this talk, you don't need to know what a quantum group is. You can just replace it with a finite group.
Yeah, can you? clarify a bit better, what's the relation between the left and right drawings?
So I can, I didn't want to explain it in much detail because that would need much longer. So I can define really a spinform model, you know, the same kind of models Benjamin described. But I take a very particular underlying triangulation. It's actually not a triangulation, but it's a funny complex. And this funny complex would have just two building blocks. But these building blocks would have many, many faces. And then I glue these two building blocks together. And so in principle, I get just the compact
object. So the two-dimensional object. On the right-hand side, you have a two-dimensional lattice.
Yeah, yeah. And then I can map this model to a model on this two-dimensional lattice.
The question is, the size of this lattice, is it related to the number of vertical legs?
Yeah,
and
yeah,
why are
exactly.
they organized in two dimensions?
Why are these organized in two dimensions? That's a choice. That's basically here you can make more choices. You know, I needed to get an interesting model. Actually, we needed four valent vertices here. And it's exactly the models you have in four dimensions. So that maybe explains, that explains why you choose a square lattice here. But it's not very important for what I mean, you can also take any triangulation or any lattice. I can take a triangular or hexagonal lattice. So this is the kind, you know, so now we have a 2D model, and Giffrey told us we can take any model and turn it into a tensor model, tensor network. So we can do that and apply the tensor network renormalization flow, and study basically these models. But let's maybe see before we do that how these models look like. And again, there are many ways to write these models, and I will write them in a particular way, which makes the symmetry obvious. So these tensor models, indeed, are, I mean, these tensor networks, which we will have, okay, will be really described as in Giffrey's talk by tensors associated to the nodes. And we will have the indices of the tensors are associated to the links of this network or to these edges. And we will have always, in this initial model, two indices. One, this J, this is what we sometimes call spin, because we usually consider SU2 or SU2K, and then these representations of SU2 are called spins. So in general, this is a representation label for the group. And M, I might call it magnetic index at some point, because that's also coming from SU2, it's just an index in a representation space of this group. And so the range of M actually in general, depends actually on the representation you have. So you have these two indices, or in other words, to each edge, you actually associate a vector space. And this vector space in these models is not just one representation space, but it is the sum over all possible representations, over all irreducible representations in this that you can have. So you have this label for this representation space plus these magnetic indices. So you can see that as one index. So basically, the index we had before was just one index per edge. And this one index is just now described by a pair of indices, so which is described here. So basically, the dynamics is or the amplitudes is encoded in this tensor. In principle, it's a four-valent tensor, but each index has a substructure. What does this global invariance mean? The global invariance means I now have these representation spaces. So these representation spaces means I can define an action on the group on these representation spaces. If I take the direct sum, it doesn't matter. It just acts, you know, just like a block matrix, so it just acts by blocks diagonally. and so if I apply the same group element, the same symmetry, on each of these edges, and let it act on this tensor, The global symmetry means that this tensor remains invariant. Okay? And this invariance condition means, for us, it means two things. These tensors will have a special form. And also, you can show that this invariance is actually preserved under gluing, under basically forming bigger and bigger lattices, which you can say gives you the partition function depending on boundary data, which are given just by all the outer edges. And this partition functions will still have a special form. So what we will try to use is we will try to preserve the special form, and we will also make use of the special form in our algorithm just to save computing resources. So what is a special form? So you have a representation space, J, and you have even kind of this index M, which defines a basis on this representation space. So in each representation space, you have an action of your group element, G.
And here the group is SU2.
Here, or a final group, or, you know, or final, you can, yeah. I mean, what I'm saying, any kind of, yeah, symmetry transformation. So basically, what I'm writing here is I could, I have the same symmetry acting on each representation space.
So that symbol means that you're taking the group acting on.
On this space, but it actually means it acts on this tensor. Because the tensor has these indices, it would act on the magnetic indices. In a way, you know, for each magnetic index, I would have to write the right.
It represents a group action.
The group action, yeah. And I. And global means that I have to take the same group element
everywhere.
For each index, yeah. So indeed, if I form a bigger lattice and I have 16 outer edges, I need to take 16 times the same group element. Yeah.
So, assuming you have a more complicated, let's say, a quantum group, so are you acting with the tensor product because this one has the group product is commutative, so it's just tensor product? So that if you had a more complicated quantum group,
So for a quantum group, you would have to go through more exercises to do that. But what I'm saying about the form of the tensors, that also applies to the tensor group. So let me not define this properly for the quantum group, but this special form will apply of the tensors will apply to quantum group structure. It's a bit easier to understand. Okay. Okay, so basically the tensors have a special form, and then in this case, if we have for simplicity, we start with a three-valent tensor, and I'm considering also a special case of groups, which is not too important now. So if you have a three-valent tensor, and you have this invariance condition, you know that the three-valent tensor as a function of these three indices factorizes into two parts, and one part only depends on these representation labels or on the spins, and another part is completely predetermined by the symmetry. It's a Clebsch-Gordan coefficient here, and this all you need to know is that this is given by the group, and basically all the magnetic indices are basically all the dependence on the magnetic indices is in this predetermined structure. And so the free data we actually have only depends on the spin labels. So if we could just deal with these spin labels, we have already won a lot, because that would basically decrease the number of variables we have to deal with by a huge factor. So in principle, we have only to care about this factor, which only depends on the spin labels. And you could say it's free data. Still, it's only almost free data. And the reason it's almost free data is that there are coupling rules. So that means that not all combinations of these bins are satisfied, are allowed. If you would have an abelian group, actually, there would be a very strong rule which would say that G3 has to be equal to the sum of J1 and J2. For SU2, it's less strict because you have these so-called triangle inequalities for each triple, basically for each ordering of your spins. And then there are more rules, like the last one only comes from this quantum group structure and says that the sum of these spins has to be bounded by this level k, which is a parameter we put in, and in principle is determined by the cosmological constant. So if these coupling rules are violated, then this tensor is zero. And obviously, that's another thing we could use, because we don't need to save when this tensor is zero. We only would need to save the non-vanishing entries. And I think that is part of the exercise. It makes a huge difference whether you take care of that or not. So this applies for a three-valent tensor. If you have a four-valent tensor, in some sense, you can always write the four-valent tensor that it already comes with an internal splitting in some sense. You can kind of make a choice for how you want to split it. And but again, you have basically a structure which is a symmetry determined and takes care of all these magnetic indices. And you have a structure which only depends on these outer spins. But in addition, you have a so-called coupling spin. And so this tensor will actually not only depend on four spins, but on five spins. So that's one example that you need to, in principle, that you add more and more spins. And that's, again, something which is a bit special to non-abelian groups. So the symmetry determined structure, again, is completely determined by these things, which come from the group. Okay, so we need to remember two things. We only want to deal with this almost free part. But in addition, you know, almost means that there are coupling rules, and taking care of these saves a lot of memory and time. And the other thing, which I'm not now going to explain, is that these representation labels might be actually interesting observables. So these labels actually carry more information than in the case where we didn't have any symmetry, as we will see. So these are the first example that we will choose here some observables and keep these observables accessible through our algorithm. In this case, for these specific models, and if you really use SU2 or SU2K, there's even a very nice geometric interpretation you can apply. And you can take all these models as models of 2D quantum geometry. So it might have nothing to do with quantum gravity, but you can extract a quantum geometry out of it. So you can extract a geometry out of it. And you can even write the usual for the TQFTs you find here, you can even write Hamiltonian and diffeomorphism constraints and solve them and find fixed points analytically if you want, and so on. So to motivate what happens, so if you really interpret these tensors, now you can basically, if you have a three-valent one, you can kind of draw the dual object that would be a triangle, and these j's you can actually take as lengths of these triangles. And the triangle inequality we have seen makes now lots of sense, because it would implement this triangle inequality automatically. And then this tensor would basically give you an amplitude for this triangle. And in addition, you have these magnetic indices. Now imagine that you glue triangles or anything to larger 2D geometries. So then you again get a boundary, a geometric boundary. And pieces of this boundary would come with these spins, and you could interpret them as lengths. So you could also, is there a way to form by basically the total length out of these many spins? And indeed, there is a way to do that. And that is basically given by coupling these spins, angular momentum coupling. You can basically form the total spin or the total representation. And mathematically, it's given by taking this tensor product. And reduce it completely to a sum of irreducible representations. And this defines you the total spin. And taking this tensor product is usually what you would do if you have lots of angular momenta and add these up. So this defines you a variable j, which is now basically, in this case, defined for one side. It's kind of a global variable. And this might be, indeed, an interesting boundary observable. And it's something which is just defined as coming from the group, because this global J just gives defines you subspaces of your symmetry group, subspaces which are invariant under the symmetry group. So what you can do here, you have basically a bunch of indices which are given by the spins and by these magnetic indices. And doing this kind of what's called reduction, it actually just means a change of basis. And you replace these indices by a new set of indices where you make explicit this total spin, J. You still have basically the magnetic index, which comes with this representation space associated with the total space. And then there are lots of other indices. And we will just call all these indices D. So it's a degeneracy index. And this includes more fine-grained information on this boundary. what we see is that we can take our original model, form a bigger lattice. But even with this bigger lattice here, 4x4, or n by n, can take any size, we can go to a change of basis and express this tensor in new indices. And we would, again, just have four indices J. We would have all these degeneracy indices. The bigger the letter, the bigger the lattice, the higher the range of this degeneracy index. And we have these magnetic indices. But this tensor would have basically, again, the same form as before. So the magnetic indices, the behavior in the magnetic indices is, again, completely predetermined. And we would have only to deal with this total spin labels and these degeneracy indices. So here we if we could ignore these degeneracy indices or do something with these degeneracy indices, we see that we have a hope to keep at least in some subspace of models, because again we just have a four-valent tensor which is labeled by J's. So in principle, we get these things from a partition function for a square with different refinements. So here we have basically just the original square. Here we would glue four squares. Could organize our variables again, that we have basically these four spins, but also more indices. And the question is now, OK, what do you require? How do you compare these models? Here, what we want to do is to find things which are invariant under how fine you partition that. We want to find such models. So we need to formulate the consistency conditions for models which we are actually interested in. And here, I've just written abstractly the consistency condition. It's already written if you basically have two lattices of different size, which in general come with basically with these degeneracy indices. But these degeneracy indices might be different, because I mean they are different in general, because we consider models coming from different sizes of the lattice. So in this example here, this d is actually just a trivial index, it's just one. And here it's something bigger because we consider a bigger lattice. what I'm requiring here is some kind of invariance condition again. It's actually a fixed point condition, as we will see. I'm saying the tensor I get for the coarser lattice should be actually the same if I take a finite tensor for the finer lattice. But I have to do something with much more indices. So what I have to choose here is a state which kind of for the boundary, which puts all my finer boundary information into a vacuum state. So now you can ask, well, how do I choose this vacuum state? In effect, it's something dynamically. And indeed, we will see that this choice will be also given by the tensor network algorithm. And so again, what I'm basically doing is just requiring that I do get the same predictions or the same observables if I ask them for a coarse lattice and I consider just coarse observables. And if I ask the same coarse observable from a finer lattice, I require that I get the same answer. But I need to say, you know, if I have a quantum field theory and you ask something for three particles, it makes a difference whether you assume that that there are much more higher energy particles around or not. So what I'm requiring, what this function should tell you, put all the higher energy particles to the vacuum state. And this is, you know, so this is kind of a more elaborate version of what Benjamin required in his flow. This was kind of the intersection of volume, that this should not depend on how you intersect it. It's kind of a finer information. I do here require basically that the coarse information, the amplitudes for the coarse information, does agree in different tensors describing different refinements of the model. And you can ask, okay, how do I get these things? And the point is that such tensors and these functions or these wave functions, as you can parameterize wave functions, you could understand them as parameterized wave functions or embedding maps, are actually produced as fixed point of the tensor renormalization flow. We started 10 minutes late. I'm a bit confused. I think I still have 7 minutes or something. So let me describe a simple class of examples. And basically, this class of examples are lattice TQFTs. So these are, again, these are the consistency equations of some objects, which are these black blobs, which are these tensors, and these yellow objects, which are some kind of embedding maps. These black dots have four outer legs. So what I can take if I have a TQFT, and in this case, I just understand as a TQFT is a three-valent tensor, which is invariant, you know, under changing where the corresponding partition function is invariant under changing this graph or the triangulation. you can take basically this three-valent tensor, glue them to a plaquette or to a square, and you get a four-valent tensor. You take this as your tensor, and then you need to decide about your embedding map. And the nice thing about the embedding map, here you see indeed the embedding map or this vacuum state is determined by the dynamics, because again, it's given by the TQFT amplitude. And as an exercise, you can now translate this equation into a translation between these objects and do some changes in your triangulation, not changing the boundary, and see indeed that this equation is satisfied. I mean, you set this as invariant under changes of the bulk triangulation, basically. And you will see that, this equation is satisfied by the property of being a TQFT. There are lots of TQFTs which come with this structure, and there's even more if you actually consider the more complicated versions, which I discussed in the very beginning. And Giffrey describes them as these corner double line tensors. It's just that these corner double line tensors are now really interesting objects, even in condensed matter. Here you see a bit indicated that in fact these corner double line tensors do indeed satisfy a kind of triangulation invariance if you are used to that. Going from here to here is a two-Pachner move in the dual description. But if you really see this corner line tensors in the tensor description, then a line just means an identity on a vector space. And so all what I'm doing is kind of, you know, slightly deforming these lines, but I'm not changing these maps. So here I go from this point to this point, and that's going from this point to this point, and this is not changed. And here I go from this point to this point, and again I just go here from this point to this point. So indeed, these are just identities on a vector space, and the question is which vector space should you choose here? And here you also get an invariance because this is just a trace on this vector space. It drops out, gives you the constant c, and what you are left is with these two identities on this vector space. And what you can do is to choose this identity on a particular vector space, and this would be the vector space on a given with a fixed spin, which is here capital J half. And this model looks trivial. If you do a little trick and just couple these double lines to one spin, you get actually non-trivial amplitude, which looks much more complicated. And actually, this amplitude is the same as appearing kind of in the simplest spin, full spin form model we know, the Ponzano-Recchi model. So it's not obvious that this is just the structure. And again, these spins now tell you something interesting because these models have a maximal spin value, and that's given by J. And so what happens is, independently in how many of these triangles you glue together, the amplitudes will always vanish. I mean, if your kind of total spin for one side is larger than J. Capital J. So it's, you see that here you have an example where indeed you have an observable which actually differentiates between phases. Actually, they're more involved fixed points, so you get a very rich structure. In addition, if you couple four of these different models, there's lots of things going on which we don't know yet. And of course, an interesting thing is whether you can classify them. I mean, here for this one model, for this one copy things, we know in principle how to classify them. It's just something which involves high-level mathematics. And you can read about it in this nice paper. Okay, so let me now make a break. And this kind of finishes the more conceptual underpinnings. And in the next lecture, I will more tell you technically what you have to do to get these models working, and then there will be, I think, a bit of time for the higher dimensional models. So
5 past, can we reconvene at 5 past?
5 past, yeah, then we don't.